Wonderful to see everyone, as always, to sit together. And today we'll be talking about this week's Torah reading, Parshat Baha'alatecha. The theme that strikes me from this Parsha and the book of Bamidbar is that people can be difficult. As humans, we have many vulnerabilities, and getting people to function well together as a community is difficult, especially when the community is dealing with traumatic loss, transitions, great uncertainty. And this is exactly the context for the book of Bamidbar. Nowhere is the challenge of leading an emotionally strong people distraught people more clear than in this week's Parsha, in which Moses completely breaks down, unable to handle the anger and demands of the people he has to lead. Just to review, after 400 years of oppression, ending with a frightening chase by Pharaoh's army as they leave Mitzrayim, the Israelites arrived at Mount Sinai and engaged in a two-year project of building the Mishkan, the traveling ark, according to God's instruction. In the process, they learn to work together and to discover a new way of being free to serve God rather than forced to serve Pharaoh. The wilderness, the book of Bamidbar, is a space in which their human vulnerabilities and challenges have to be expressed and addressed. They have to come to the surface after centuries of oppression in Mitzrayim, after these years of oppression have pushed all that anger and rebellion down. The community must learn about its impulses, desires, and weaknesses before it settles in the land where it hopes to become a peaceful and prosperous nation. Leadership has to learn how to tolerate the complaints, the blame, the anger of the people. One might hope that the community could simply express its darker impulses, learn from its mistakes, resolve its conflicts, and move on to live happily ever after in the Holy Land. But Torah is not a fairy tale, and as Reb Yocheved often has taught, Torah is not a prescription, it's a description of the human condition, of our inner landscape. So it's worth looking at how this book, Bamidbar, highlights the many different ways that we as humans can undermine ourselves with delusion and sabotage our good fortune with impulsivity and aggression, and also some suggestions on how to treat those problems. In this week's Torah reading, the children of Israel set out from the mountain to resume their journey to the Holy Land. During the 2 years they camped at Sinai, Mount Sinai, the Torah was given, the Mishkan was built, the priestly vestments were sewn, and the Kohanim and Levites were instructed in all the sacrifices and rituals and housekeeping, all the things that were to keep the channel open between God and the people so they could truly understand how to serve God rather than serve their own impulses or another master. So they accomplished a lot in those 2 years, and they're not yet aware that it will take 40 years of wandering, death, and loss to become ready to enter the Holy Land. Evidently, it's much easier for the community to come together to build a Mishkan, to follow a divine plan, and to get organized to do complicated rituals than it is for them to learn how to function as a community under the stress of migration along an uncertain path with an uncertain future. Torah says, it was in the second year, in the second month, on the 20th of the month, that the children of Israel marched forth from the wilderness of Sinai, headed to the Holy Land. Rashi comments on a midrash that says the journey was to take 3 days, and yet it took 40 years. No sooner had they set out, guided by the cloud presence of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh during the day and the fire presence of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh by night, than the people took to complaining bitterly before Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh heard and was incensed. A fire of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh broke out against them. The people cried out to Moses, who prayed to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and the fire died down. No sooner had the fire been quelled than complaints broke out again. If only we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we used to eat free in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. Now we have nothing but this manna. Moses heard the people weeping, each person at the entrance of his tent. But that was not the only emotional storm he had to contend with. Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh had also gotten very angry and vengeful. And at that moment, Moses got completely overwhelmed. I think this is a moment we can relate to as a parent, a leader, as someone responsible for the well-being of others. You have to work very hard to contain and manage the emotional distress of others. That challenge may feel manageable when you have a source of support and containment yourself, a friend, a mentor, a partner, a therapist, a teacher. And if all else fails, one might have a sense of God's compassionate presence in the world, the way we may call up an image like being in the hands of God when we feel a need to be held. But in this overwhelming moment, Moses sees that God can no longer contain God's own anger, can no longer be the sustaining presence that Moses counts on. And Moses cries out in desperation, "Why have you dealt ill with your servant, and why have I not enjoyed your favor that you have laid the burden of all this people upon me? Did I conceive this people? Did I bear them that you should say to me, 'Carry them in your bosom as a nurse carries an infant to the land you have promised on oath to their fathers'?" In these lines, I hear the most explicit recognition I have seen in Torah of how hard it is to be a parent. Moses is crying out, "I can't carry them in my bosom like a nurse carries an infant. I'm not up to the task to being a nursemaid to difficult people." But in fact, this is exactly what parents have to do, what teachers have to do, what anybody who has any role in a community has to do. We have to carry others with compassion and care when they are weeping, complaining, and intent on getting something they can't have. And they're yelling, "I need it now." Moses goes on, "Where am I to get the meat they demand? I cannot carry all these people by myself. It's too much for me. If you would deal with me in this way, kill me instead, I beg you." But in this moment, Moses cannot see clearly. He feels that the only way to solve the problem is to get the people the meat that they demand, to satisfy a craving they are expressing, a craving that will never be satisfied by getting them what they demand. They demand meat because it's symbolic of a life of comfort that they imagine that they had in Egypt, but they never actually had. And they're not going to find that comfort by being fed meat in the desert. If we think about our job as parents, teachers, managers, responsible adults, members of a community, when a child or a distraught adult demands something that is not realistic, we know that the problem usually cannot be solved by just getting them the thing they demand. The problem is their distress. They want something to make them feel better, and they imagine a certain thing will do it. But when it's not available, we have to help them find a way to feel comforted without the thing they demand. We have to help them make the best of whatever reality is offering in the moment. And our loving attention is a wonderful thing to offer. In the Buddhist tradition, the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path are a prescription for addressing this kind of fight with reality, a demand for something that is not available in reality. The Four Noble Truths remind us that we bring an added layer of suffering into our already difficult lives by craving for things that are not possible. And the peace comes not from getting what we crave, but from learning how to manage the craving. The Eightfold Path prescribes the types of meditation study and ethical leading that can be done to deal with cravings and make peace with reality as it is. So let's take a look at how God responds to Moses in his moment of breakdown. In a fascinating combination of reason and reactivity, God first instructs Moses, "Gather for me 70 of Israel's elders and bring them to the tent of meeting. I will come down and speak with you there. I will draw upon the spirit that is on you and put it upon them. They will share the burden of the people with you. You shall not bear it alone." And this is exactly what Moses needs, an answer to his desperate prayer to share the burden of carrying these people. But in the next moment, God becomes vengeful, saying, "You people ask for meat? Well, that's what you'll get until it's literally coming out of your nostrils and becoming loathsome to you. For you have rejected the Lord by whining and saying, 'Why did we ever leave Egypt?'" God is reacting with vengeance to their rejection of God's gift of liberation. God's feelings are hurt, and God is taking this all too personally. Moses responds by questioning, "How could God provide enough flocks and herds or enough fish from the sea to satisfy 600,000 men?" And the Lord responds to Moses' doubt with defensiveness. Is there a limit to the Lord's power? You'll see that whatever I said will happen, will happen. Somehow, even in the face of God's tantrum in this moment, Moses is able to regain his balance with the promise of support from the elders. He gathers the 70 elders. The Lord came down in a cloud and drew upon the spirit that was on Moses and put it on the elders. And when the spirit rested upon them, they spoke in ecstasy. In other words, they could also receive the word of God. Now, the spirit also rested on two other men, Eldad and Medad, who were not among the 70. And they also spoke in ecstasy. And when Joshua reports this to Moses, saying, "Restrain them," Moses is unperturbed. "Are you wrought up on my account? Would that all the Lord's people were prophets, and the Lord put his spirit upon them." Here we see a remarkable recovery as Moses quickly regains equanimity once he has the support of the 70 elders who can also receive the word of God. He no longer feels alone. He's sharing the burden, so he doesn't feel threatened by others receiving the spirit of God. He welcomes other prophets. Just as we can understand Moses feeling totally overwhelmed when he had to carry the burden of the people alone, we can also identify with that feeling of relief when we can share responsibility and depend on others for help. So, in our discussion of Bamidbar, I want to take a step back and look at other eruptions of human frailty in Bamidbar and how there are some effective ways to manage these weaknesses, particularly in the Torah reading from last week, Naso. So last week in TBZ's Shabbat Torah study, we looked at two problems and two different sets of ritual observances to address them. The first, the infamous ritual of Sota, addresses the problem of the jealous husband who's obsessed with the belief that his wife has had relations with another man. In the words of Torah, if a rush of jealousy comes over him and he feels rage toward his wife, whether she has lain with another man or not, there is a ritual to address the problem. There's no assumption that the wife is guilty. The words of Torah indicate that the problem we are addressing is not the wife's behavior, but the husband's rage, and probably the accompanying risk of domestic violence. The solution for this problem is an ordeal, a ritual that is clearly horrible and degrading to the wife, but is entirely likely to indicate that the wife is innocent. The woman has to drink the water of bitterness bringing the bane, a mixture of sacred water and dirt, with the written words of a curse that contains the letters Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh rubbed off into it. If it makes her belly swell and thigh sag, she's guilty, but if she's innocent, her body will not be distorted and she may bear seed. Given the likely non-toxic nature of this drink, it's unlikely to produce evidence of unfaithfulness. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks notes that it was so important to God to keep peace in the home that God was willing to let the sacred letters of God's name be dissolved for the sake of vindicating the wife and restoring peace in the home. Immediately after, we read about the Nazirite who for a time chooses to set himself apart, stops cutting his hair, refrains from all wine and beer. When he has fulfilled his time as a Nazirite, he brings offerings, including a purification or hatat offering, often translated as a sin offering. He takes part in an elaborate ritual to be welcomed back into the community. No reason is given for why someone would choose to become a Nazir. However, one can't help but wonder whether this is a way of managing an addictive behavior, cravings for alcohol or other addictive behaviors that require a removal from temptation and being set apart and learning new ways of being and returning only after purification offerings. So in these examples, we see how the community is threatened by impulsivity, paranoia, addictive behaviors, and unfulfillable cravings. Torah offers rituals and religious practice to treat these disorders. The vulnerabilities of the community and their leaders arise and are expressed as fear, rebellion, lack of faith, and aggression along this journey. We learn in the weeks ahead whether confronting and addressing these human frailties as they wander through the wilderness, whether this can indeed transform these traumatized people into a community that is ready to thrive in the Holy Land. So let's take a moment of silence and then we'll discuss.